Kia ora. G'day. I'm Dr. Elise Dowden, and I am the organiser and founder of the Australasian Post-Humanities. We exist to make the humanities radically accessible, and you can find out more at apost-humanities.org. Our seminar series here is organised on the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation, who we acknowledge as traditional owners and custodians. Paying respects to Indigenous elders past and present, it always was and always will be Aboriginal land.
Thanks everyone for joining today. We're going to have a good chat with Dr. Hannah McCann and Shelley Zuchen about their work on gender and the pursuit of beauty. Dr. Hannah McCann is a senior lecturer in cultural studies at the University of Melbourne, and her research is in critical femininity studies, which explores feminist discourse on femininity, queer femme LGBTQ plus communities, beauty culture, and queer fangirls. Her monograph, Queering Femininity, Sexuality, Feminism, and the Politics of Presentation, was published with Routledge in 2018, and her co-authored textbook, Queer Theory Now, From Foundations to Futures, with Red Globe Press in 2020. You can read about her recent beauty work project at beautysalonproject.com and find her on Twitter at @finaredis. Shelley Zuchen is a PhD candidate at Monash University School of Film, Media and Journalism. Their current research focuses on the junction between contemporary feminist scholarship and queer visibility in the media. Shirley's thesis considers how feminist subject positions and ideologies shape perceptions and representations of queer men on television and social media. Some of their work on this can be found in the European Journal of Cultural Studies. Maybe, Hannah, you'd like to start and tell us a little bit about yourself and a bit about your work?
Sure. Well, that was a great introduction, and it covered a lot of it already. But yeah, I think the main thing to emphasize is that my area of specialization is critical femininity studies, which really arose, for people that don't know, as a kind of response to masculinity studies popularity. So of course, like, the history of feminist theory has often engaged with questions of femininity, but there hasn't been a dedicated field for femininity studies before this. And it really kind of started happening in the 2000s, and it's much more popular now. So when I started my PhD in 2012, there wasn't actually that many people writing about it. And now I feel like there's a lot more people writing about femininity, and not just from a perspective of, you know, critical engagement, that is seeing femininity as a problem, but also seeing the kind of potentials of femininity, the lived experiences of femininity, and the kind of like an interest in it, I suppose, where there's a lot of room for, like, I don't always say celebrating femininity, but taking it seriously at least.
Awesome. Excited to hear more about it. And Shirley, would you like to tell us a little bit about your work as well?
Yeah, so my PhD is kind of looking at the intersection between feminism and queer theory. So right now, I'm looking at reality TV, and I'm studying Queer Eye and RuPaul's Drag Race. And I think one of the really kind of interesting kind of aspects of those shows is the way that they're talked about really as alternative masculinities or reimagining male practices. But the way that the angle that I'm coming at it from is really like looking at them as feminine practices and kind of seeing the ways in which women or like feminized or feminine audiences relate to these shows. Yeah, and the other thing is I did my honours actually on queer male beauty influences, which is actually how I ended up on Hannah's project about beauty.
Nice. I bet you both have big opinions on The Bachelorette, but I should maybe not mention that too early. So yeah, what are we both listening to, thinking about, reading this month?
I've been trying to get into the zeitgeist, so I forced myself to watch Squid Game. And it was really harrowing. I don't know how many people watched it here, but like, I really don't like gore, and it was definitely the goriest thing I've ever watched. But I'm really glad I did watch it. And I've also been, like, as just the most stereotypical millennial thing, I've been reading the Sally Rooney book. And I've just started watching The Bisexual Bachelorette, so thanks for mentioning that. It's the highlight of my life right now. So yeah, that's what I'm engaging. This is probably meant to be an academic question. What am I reading academically? Nah. But I've just had some leave, so I haven't been reading anything academically.
I think that's good. How about you, Shirley?
I am currently doing that thing where I convince myself I'm being productive by marathoning RuPaul's Drag Race because I am technically studying it. I've just smashed through season two in like 2 days.
Nice.
And I'm on to season three right now. I've kind of watched them out of order though. I've already watched 12 and 13 and I've watched 6 and 7. It's just been a bit of a, I've just been going through it.
How would we define femininity and masculinity? I'm going to just sort of ask these questions, I suppose, and maybe you both can just jump in however you see fit. Yeah, so how would we define femininity and masculinity?
You want to go, Shelley? It's so hard.
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, it's a really difficult question. It's funny, actually, I was reading Hannah's book a couple of months ago, and in the introduction, she literally says, you can't define femininity, so possibly asked the wrong person this question. it's one of those things. I've been reading Female Masculinity recently, Jack Halberstam similarly kind of talks about masculinity as, like, this thing that you can recognize, but you're not able to pinpoint. It's kind of like this nebulous sense of the essence of like a gender, I guess. But it's, yeah, there's definitely kind of very little concrete way to define these things. I think particularly like, one of the things that I've been struggling with as well is the way that Queer Eye and RuPaul's Drag Race, for example, are kind of spoken about from the lens of masculinity, but I'm kind of trying to push back against that a little bit. But at the same time, there is this kind of very difficult process of decoupling masculinity from maleness, which I don't feel you can fully do. Like, there is this entanglement there, but I guess there's this general kind of sense that masculinity and femininity are practices and aesthetics and behaviors broadly. It's definitely difficult to kind of really pinpoint that.
Absolutely. And I guess there are lots of blurred lines around everything as well.
Yeah, I think like there's different approaches. Like there's some people who would argue that kind of like anyone that's a woman expresses femininity in different ways. And that's a kind of descriptive way of understanding femininity. But there's a really important point made by queer theorists like Jack Halberstam, which is that we need to be able to decouple these things so we can understand different expressions don't align necessarily with gender that you've adopted or assigned. You know, it's that those things can be separated. The other thing is that sometimes femininity and masculinity refer to roles and traits, and then other times, well, most of the time, they really refer to appearances, or at least the appearances are the gateway to understanding what the expected traits are. And I think it's actually really important. I think it gets downplayed that femininity is associated with appearance, or that masculinity is associated with appearance, because of this kind of like desire to do that decoupling from the bodily. But actually, because there is such an important signaling that happens through appearance, that's how I've tended to approach femininity, as surface being really, really important. And I've been much less interested in the traits, so much more about surface appearances. And that's why, you know, I wrote my earlier work on queer femme expression, which was about people in the LGBTQ community who are like align themselves with a kind of feminine presentation. And their experiences of marginalization, because they're read as kind of not transgressing gender expectations in a queer way. And then when I finished my PhD, I wanted to keep looking at these questions of femininity and appearance and expectations, but not just looking at femme identity specific to LGBTQ identity. So that's why I went to the beauty salon as a site, because I think, you know, it's funny, I did end up writing my first paper on this project about queer salons, but in general, the hair and beauty salon is seen as a really heterosexual site, actually. It's a reproduction of very heterosexual norms of beauty and gender. And really interested in how we can actually queer our understanding of that space. So, yeah, I'm all for, like, thinking about it in terms of appearance a lot, like actually emphasising that as important.
I was thinking about all my own experiences of being in salons, and that is a really interesting point, that it is quite a heterosexual space, because the expectation is that what you're putting on or what you're changing about yourself is for like a heterosexual audience.
Well, just like in order to meet norms of appearance, norms being heterosexual in a dominant heterosexual society. The really interesting thing, of course, being that there's so many different salons, the nature of them means that there is a kind of salon to suit everyone, really, in different communities. But that's much more accessible if you have money, and also in urban areas. So it's more fraught once you get outside of the city.
Yeah, not to mention like the politics of having your hair cut in a certain way and all sorts of, yeah. I'm not sure how to ask this question, because it's hard to define femininity and masculinity in the first place. But maybe we could have a go at defining like feminine masculinity or masculine femininity, or just saying something about what we mean when we talk about these concepts.
Yeah, I think like one of the things, I guess it's really important to preface, like one of the reasons that I was studying gay male beauty influencers specifically is because a lot of them have much larger followings than their female counterparts. So like, you know, the highest followed at the time, they have much more followers now, but the highest followed influencers when I was studying them had maybe like, you know, up to 5 million more followers than like some of the highest followed female influencers. So that was like really interesting to me that, the practice of femininity by men was seemingly so elevated compared to the practice of femininity by women. I think the difficulty there is that like, because I'm not characterizing these practices as masculine, I'm not characterizing them as masculinity, it kind of becomes really important, like Hannah was saying, to decouple maleness from masculinity. And so for me, I'm not really looking at masculine femininity so much as I'm kind of arguing that they're effectively very similar practices, but I'm using the term in my work, I don't know if I'm going to continue using it, but right now I'm using the term maleness to talk about it, because like obviously there's also a lot of there's a lot of drag queens, for example, who are trans women, and there are a lot of non-binary drag queens, and so it's not so much that men practice these things, but that there is this sense that this space is coded male, and so the term maleness kind of creates a level of fluidity there to kind of talk about the way that these spaces and these bodies are read and coded, but not necessarily making a statement about the particular gender identities of the people who practice these things. So for me, like, I guess with the masculine femininities and the feminine masculinities, like for me, I'm kind of not using those terminologies deliberately. I guess it's very difficult as well, because I'm trying to situate gender as this kind of process of social reading and social communication, and not just like literally the embodied kind of
And especially when it's not like these aren't things that people have necessarily had the words for before. So it's, I guess there's going to be some difficulty in finding those words.
I think, the series that's on at the moment of UK Drag Race has the faux queen on it, who's the woman who does drag. And it's really interesting because in my experiences, and kind of asking people about this, like when you do that level of kind of drag queen presentation of femininity, there's a real presumption of maleness underneath, like it doesn't matter who you are. And that's just, I guess that just goes to your point, Shirley, that you're saying like the space of drag coded as a male space. And like, I remember I marched in Mardi Gras one year in like a kind of drag unicorn outfit, and people absolutely thought that my gender was a man. And it was really, really interesting because I got like treated in a different way. And I just think it's an interesting thing about like the presentation of drag and the assumption about what that means about your gender identity. Mm. But then there's another interesting element to that, which is that femininity is always seen as an artifice. So drag is like the next level of that. It's like artifice on top of, you know, something else. But the generally femininity is seen as a put on, as a masquerade. That's how it's understood. Whereas masculinity is seen as like a stripping back, as not involving layers of things, which is makes there's a different kind of conundrum of presentation for drag kings in that. Mm. It'd be really interesting to see a drag king on RuPaul.
Oh, totally. That would be amazing.
Yeah.
I think I read an article very briefly. I forgot what the show is called, but I think someone is making a show that will include drag queens and drag kings. And I think it's being hosted by like some Drag Race alumni. It came up in my news recommendations, but I've totally forgotten.
Yeah. So we've talked a bit about, yeah, I guess the conversation so far has mostly revolved around like digital representations of like gendered beauty. And yeah, so what are your takes on like how these things help or hinder our own understandings of our gender identities?
It's such a good question. Like, what possibilities are made through these representations? And actually, one of the interviews that I've done for the project, one of the participants, I don't know if you remember this, Shirley, talked about how Drag Race actually made them feel kind of more excited about makeup and confident about like feeling like they didn't have to be ashamed of wanting to wear makeup as like a feminist, and that it was actually giving them this space of possibility to experiment and have fun and want to get into femininity in this other way, in this kind of queer way, and not in a way that where they felt like it was attached to their experiences of being forced into femininity growing up and by, you know, society and their parents and so on, and the kind of norms that they had to meet. So I think, you know, it opens up space not just for people that want to be drag queens, but for people to think about femininity differently in general. And it's a space where femininity is celebrated, which is really interesting. And the bit where that becomes dangerous or contentious, I suppose, is where the celebration aligns with like really strong beauty norms, like tiny waists and sculpted faces in particular ways. And the show, sorry Shirley, I feel like I'm talking way too much about your area, Drag Race, but it's just because I watch so much of it. You know, the show used to have really, really strict norms about what an appropriate drag queen looked like, and the drag community really pushed back on that to say, no, actually drag is much queerer than this in terms of queering expectations of gender. And they've adapted to that. So you see less of it now, but you still see a lot of the queens who get really celebrated by the judges as very kind of normatively feminine. So it's interesting space where it's like at once opening up this space of possibility and then simultaneously presenting some reification of the norms of femininity that we expect.
I just thought it was really interesting because in my honors research where I looked at the popularity of gay male beauty influences, there's this kind of sense, like you were saying before, Hannah, that femininity is kind of associated always with artifice, right? And so there's this real tension between, like, you know, these neoliberal needs to be an authentic individual and that kind of drive towards, like, you know, being your true self, and yet femininity always being associated with artifice. And I think, like, you know, one of the arguments I made there was that there's a kind of resolution of that tension when the practice of femininity is kind of mediated by maleness in a way. So it's kind of one of those things where, like, I definitely had mixed feelings about it because, you know, it is wonderful to see a celebration of femininity, and it's wonderful to kind of have, you know, this show that allows people to explore this particular mode of gender expression without feeling shame. But at the same time, it really troubles me that that has to be kind of enabled through maleness. And that, you know, there's not kind of this same reverence towards, like, kind of hyperfemininity practiced by women.
Yeah, and I guess that, it's like, well, you should just be good at that, so we're not going to applaud you for that or something like that.
And yeah, there's always going to be, like, I guess, this fraught relationship. And like, almost like there's, you know, when feminine practices are kind of adopted and kind of visible on, like, masculine or male bodies, there is this sense of, like, I guess, this fantasy of celebration that I suppose a lot of women don't necessarily have access to, because there are these kind of more complicated legacies of, like, you know, labor and of kind of, you know, the compulsoriness of presenting a certain way or of artifice. It's difficult because there's a lot of sides to it, for sure.
I think, like, it's hard because obviously you have figures like Kim Kardashian or pop stars like, you know, Katy Perry or whatever, whose femininity is really over the top and celebrated. But those characters are always understood critically as kind of dupes, right? As people who don't have a lot of agency necessarily. Obviously, there's people that have written whole PhDs about how much agency Kim Kardashian has. But, like, you know, at the same time, just generally, there's that assumption, I think, that feminine femininity is associated with capitulation, whereas a kind of masculine femininity is associated with agency, even though there's, like, such intense denigration of that at the same time. So there's kind of, like, celebration of figures like Kim Kardashian, denigration of kind of masculine femininity, particularly for people, you know, growing up and expressing their femininity as men is really difficult. So there's those two things going on. But then when we kind of come to analyzing it, it's like it kind of inverts and you have this, like, dupe versus agent set up theoretically, which is really the conundrum is.
Yeah, 100%. Like, I do think obviously the kind of prevalence of you know, queer men wearing makeup and queer men wearing dresses is this kind of really wonderful representation for young queer people, and there are definitely a lot of people who have genuinely felt seen and empowered by that, but it's kind of interesting on this very, like, broad, so, like, sociocultural scale and on the level of, like, audiences more broadly, particularly when you look at, like, television executives explicitly stating that Queer Eye and RuPaul's Drag Race are targeted towards heterosexual women. There is that kind of more broadly troubling relationship, I think. And I think, like, I suppose my struggle as well is I don't want to erase the good things that can come from this type of representation, like Hannah kind of has suggested about, like, the celebration of femininity and the ability to alternatively express yourself. Like, a lot of those things are really important and, like, really wonderful things to have access to and have representation of. I think on the kind of flip side of that, I do find the kind of general the general sort of audience attitude towards these shows is, like, this real reverence of, like, you know, like, oh, isn't this incredible? Like, this is such fantastic representation. And there's this sort of, you know, there's this inability to critique them when I think there are some troubling things happening there as well. Yeah, it's quite fraught. Like, there's a lot of There's a lot going on there.
It's so hard to write about femininity and masculinity. Like, it's just, you get into these kind of knots of thinking about it, and it's really hard because often what's happening is kind of both things simultaneously, like celebration and denigration. And it's just not, you know, you're in an impossible bind a lot of the time when it comes to femininity. So there's a lot of assumptions about, you know, we can look at the bisexual bachelorette. It's a really good example because I just want to talk about it. You know, there's this critique at the moment that kind of circulating that all of the women that are on have been cast on the show are quite femme presenting, and you know, that's not very representative of the diversity of gender representation in queer communities, which is true. And it would be so great to see some, you know, more butch presenting women on the show. It would be amazing. I mean, just in general, like, of course everyone looks exactly the same every season, but at the same time, you know, actually that shows a lack of understanding of how much kind of negativity is experienced by femmes, because there's this assumption that they're straight. And so presenting on primetime television, these femmes who are queer really openly showing desire for a woman, you know, kissing another woman, and it's not for men, it's not this heteroflexible performative queerness, that's really radical and that's really amazing. And so, yeah, like going back to that impossible bind, it's like an assumption that oh well, this is just the culturally lauded femininity, we're seeing it all over again, without that recognition of the denigration that's experienced, the kind of what Ashley Rhea Hoskin calls femphobia that's experienced, that's attached to the expression of femininity that queer femmes feel very sharply. There's always the assumption that femme sexuality is for the male gaze. Like, that's the dominant assumption. And that particularly in the 2000s with so-called raunch culture and a lot of representations of queerness, there was an assumption that it was for male desire and pleasure. It was all performance. And I wrote about in my book about how a lot of the feminist analyses of these scenes, even in things like Girls Gone Wild, right? Like these shows that were produced like for the male gaze, that actually, as you say, there was another reading that was possible, that was a very minor reading that no one was doing, which was that actually that space where you can, you know, that's opened up for women to be into each other, even if it's meant to be a performance for men, actually it's a queer space that it opens up, like that possibility. I remember that. I remember this in like my first kiss with a woman was when I did it, like I was, you know, on a college bus and I was like, let's kiss for my boyfriend or whatever, which is awful. But that was when I was like, and I kissed a woman, I was like, oh my God, women are so attractive. You know, like, and it really blew my brain. But that heteroflexible male gaze performative culture is what actually made space for me to explore my queerness. And so, yeah, I guess, I'm kind of saying a lot of things here, but the first thing is that there's an assumption that's always for the male gaze. Even when it is for the male gaze, there's still something queer going on. There's a potential that's opened up there. And most importantly, with shows like The Bisexual Bachelorette, like, you know, it's not fair to just see that as part of the male gaze. And I mean, it would be really interesting to see, do an audience studies approach to it as well, because I think, you know, I don't see that it is for the male gaze in the way it's being presented or received. But I have a very specific bubble, so it would be interesting to know. Really interesting.
I missed the first episode, unfortunately, but I did watch it last night and I was very excited. I was just thinking, because one of my supervisors teaches a unit on reality TV, and she often talks to her students, you know, about different shows, and some of the stuff they say is really fascinating. She said that she got them to write an essay about The Bachelor, and the majority of them kind of talked about how the Bachelor and Bachelorette franchise is so genuine and so authentic. And I guess like the most fascinating thing was kind of, I guess, coming from a community of academics to kind of seeing, I guess, what these students are thinking and how they're relating to these shows, particularly, I guess, having less experience with like media critique and that sort of thing. It was kind of so interesting to see how the majority of them kind of came out of that franchise with this kind of real sense of like, oh, this is true love, this is so real. And I'm really interested to see, I guess, if a similar perspective is kind of happening with a queer bachelorette, especially because one of the books that I've been reading kind of touches on this concept of compulsory authenticity, which is this idea that queer representation is conflated always with authenticity and always with someone being their true self. Like some of the examples of this, I think like in the early seasons of Big Brother, one of the winners or the runner-up was a trans woman, I think. And there was this kind of real sense of celebration because this person was so real and so themselves. And so there's this kind of real conflation of queerness as a concept with truth and with identity. So I'm really interested to see if those dynamics kind of play out in like the general audienceship of the current season of The Bachelorette.
That's such an important point about queerness being read as like always like hyper authentic, even when perhaps it's, I don't know how you rate authenticity, how anyone can, you know, but yeah.
Yeah, the point in the book is that like authenticity, like kind of, it's not real. It's like this, you know, there is no stable true inner self that you have to like dig through all these layers to find. Like that doesn't exist, you know. You're as a subject, you're always culturally situated, you're always informed by your society, you're always going to behave in a way that you know is kind of related to the people around you and the world in which you live. So there's kind of not this like stable true self, but you know, because there is this real kind of neoliberal drive to discover the self and you know, present authentically, like one of the kind of hallmarks of queer visibility is this kind of sense that queerness represents that. And that's one of the arguments in the book, is like that's why people are drawn to queerness, often in, I suppose, quite shallow ways.
Yeah, like another form of bad faith. How do we think that one's own personal expectations of gender performativity shape what we consider to be work?
Well, this question of work when it comes to presentation is like one of my main interests at the moment with the beauty salon project, because when we outsource beauty work, you can see it as labor. Mm-hmm. But when we do it ourselves in the home, we rarely think of it as labor. It's really interesting to think about the slippage between a beauty routine and a beauty regime. And when something is like meditative or enjoyable, you know, getting ready to go out when we used to be able to go out and or like getting ready for the day, that ritual versus the sense of like having to do something and have like the chore of beauty that can happen, which is like, I have to, you know, shave my legs, or I have to wax my bikini, I have to put on makeup today, otherwise I'm going to look awful. And that those things can just be, that feeling can change day to day, but also happen simultaneously or feel the same. And so I'm really interested in those lines. But the most interesting thing being kind of like, once you pay someone else to do it, you're acknowledging that's work, right? And that it actually is labor to do any of those things.
I mean, I'm not sure what the general kind of consensus is, but I know that there is certainly like a lot of erasure of the labor of hairdressers, for example. Like, I've definitely, you know, had conversations with people complaining about how expensive it is and how it's not worth it and all of those things. So I think even though I guess there's this kind of tacit acknowledgement of labor, it's not really necessarily like consciously seen as you know, someone performing this labor for you. It's kind of, you know, a lot of the times it's just seen as this thing that you have to do, and that the worker is really secondary to that.
Well, the bit of labor that's hidden, I think that's the thing, is that it's the technical labor is understood, but the other layers of labor that we're looking at, the emotional labor particularly, and the identity curation label, like actually interpreting someone's desires, like the amount of people I've interviewed that have said, I just want someone to look into my soul and understand who I am and give me that haircut, right? That's the labor that's obscured. So you think, why would I pay like $120 for someone to just technically cut off some of my hair, when actually the labor that's going on in the salon becomes so much greater than the sum of parts that is just you, you know, shaving your own head at home. You know, that's the labor that's obscured. But when we're in a quarantine context, this is some other work I've done with Claire Southerton on TikTok quarantine hair trends. One of the really interesting things, it hasn't come out yet. We've got a revise and resubmit, which is nightmarish. But one of the trends in the videos is like women cutting their boyfriend's hair under the hashtag quarantine hair. And this really interesting kind of like gendering of labor that happened when everything got re-domesticated. And, you know, you think about like the emotional elements of that as well. So like not just the technical, even in the home, when it's like, you know, having to do that labor for someone else and having to like do a good job and comfort them in this like time of distress and so on. So I don't know, Shelley, do you agree with that? Like that's the bit, that's the missing chunk of like what we don't see when it comes to labor for people like hairdressers, and that actually I would hope that the beauty project work we're doing is like illuminating that, and like pay them more, have a higher minimum wage. That should be like the outcome of this.
Yeah, I do think that obviously the kind of primary aspect of the labor that is erased is that kind of emotional process as opposed to the technical side. I guess I'm just thinking about, a lot of my friends don't have a fixed hairdresser, so it's kind of interesting. You don't really get that kind of development of the relationship with your hairdresser, right? I don't know. I think even to an extent, the technical elements of hairdressing are kind of overlooked. Not because, like, obviously you go to a hairdresser because you know you can't cut your hair yourself, right? And there is this recognition that someone does this thing that you don't know how to do. But I think in a lot of ways, it's still not really fully acknowledged. And like, there's not this, you kind of, you know, you don't always go to the hairdresser thinking about the laborer and, you know, the work that they're going to do on you. You go to the hairdresser, particularly if you don't have a fixed relationship with your hairdresser, you know, you go to your hairdresser and then you kind of leave with a haircut, and kind of what happened in between, you don't really think about that in a lot of ways. So like, I obviously there is this kind of really intense emotional management aspect, and that's like in our project, a lot of the interviewees do have close relationships with their hairdressers. So there is that emotional labor aspect and this kind of real confusion around the nature of the intimacy that comes with that. But I think for a lot of people who don't have that relationship with their hairdresser, even like the technical elements of hairdressing are overlooked in a lot of ways. Like it's not necessarily this process you see as involving another human, you know what I mean? Like, or like it's not acknowledged in that way.
I think a lot of like perhaps work that's seen as feminine is, this happens like when I was doing cake decorating and makeup stuff, people would always be like, it's that much? And you're like, well, like, yeah. And also the learning of having, like, how to touch people's faces, that was quite a big thing for a lot of people. And for me, like, because you think you put makeup on, you know, but you have to, like, put your little finger on this, you know, like, you don't just put your whole hand on someone's face. No one wants your hands in their face. So yeah, there's all these funny little dances, I suppose, that we're not thinking about.
Well, that's the thing is, like, even if it's just a one-off visit, there's a lot of management of a person that's going on, right? Like, you have to establish enough trust that you can be in their personal space and touching their head, or if they're another kind of beauty worker, it might be like touching their inner thighs, you know, touching their face, doing makeup. And that's not a normal physical relation that we have with anyone else, really. Like, our partners don't even usually touch our scalps, or our friends don't touch our, you know, legs and like hands if you're getting a manicure, right? Like, so even in the very transactional one-off event, there's a lot of things going on that's being managed there about a person's experiences. And of course that can go really badly, and people can have really negative experiences because actually no salon workers are not trained in this. Like, that one thing we can say is that there's no training, essentially. So nothing in the units of study about actually interacting with people, which seems bizarre. They have, you know, most of the kind of qualifications have something that's about like ascertaining what the customer wants. So it's like how to have a conversation to make sure that, you know, you understand when they say they want this kind of haircut, that you give them that kind of haircut. That's it. There's nothing about the sociality of the space, and that's just learnt on the job. And a lot of people enter things like hairdressing really, really young, you know, 16. They're getting paid an apprentice wage, which is really low, very exploitative conditions most of the time. A lot of people have extremely negative experiences as apprentices. So it's a pretty, it's not a great kind of furnace to be creating these characters in, who are going to have so much contact with people. And then, yeah, all that emotional stuff's learnt on the job. So it's very, it can be very hit and miss. And I think that speaks to why some people just have had really, really negative experiences in salons, really negative.
So are the categories, we've got two categories, so the categories of beauty work and the category of self-care. Are these categories, or how are these categories intertwined? I think they probably are intertwined. So how are the categories of beauty work and self-care intertwined? And what kind of impact does this have on beauty workers?
I feel like maybe Shirley and I come from very different angles on this. Like, yeah, I tend to emphasize the kind of identity curation that's happening in these spaces. And Shirley helpfully emphasizes the kind of neoliberal post-feminist aspects of some of this emphasis on self-care. So I don't know, Shirley, do you want to speak to that?
I don't know. I think self-care is really interesting because it is so framed as this really neoliberal process in a lot of ways. Like, I'm thinking about watching Queer Eye, for example, and there's this really interesting episode about a man who lives in an RV and like doesn't really shower. He works in like a youth camp, and so he's like, oh, you know, I can jump in the river if I want to wash myself. And I thought that was really cool. I was like, oh yeah, man, you know, live your life, that's awesome. And it was kind of really interesting to see the Fab Five come in and be like, well, actually you're doing this because you don't respect yourself. And I think the really kind of fascinating thing about the episode was that they ended up being right in a way, or I suppose the episode was framed as if they were right. And it kind of, you know, it did really conclude with him sort of being like, oh, I do need to take better care of myself. You know, I need to cut my hair and dress a little bit neater because I deserve to feel good about myself. And I thought that was kind of, yeah, it's really fascinating because it does have this kind of really tense relationship, I guess, with like these quite, I guess, like these quite neoliberal practices. Like the other thing is, like I come from a very working class family. And so like stuff like skincare and all that, like that didn't exist in my life. Like it was not a thing, but I never felt as if I was missing anything. You know what I mean? So it's like, it is this kind of really interesting tension between like taking this time to respect yourself and care for yourself versus like, you know, here's what you need to participate in the real world. Here's what you need to participate in this kind of like visibility within society.
And I think like we have this saying, treat yourself, right? Which is like, you know, take care of yourself and like go get a manicure and go to the spa and have a haircut. And it's really interesting because someone else is doing that work. And I think, you know, there's a lot of ways you can interpret what's going on. Well, there's a lot of things going on there, and all the things that Shirley was pointing out are going on there. But one of the things when you start to think about the emotional work that happens in the salon is like how, what's being treated? You know, it's not just someone giving you attention and pampering you, like it is that, but it's this other level of someone listening to you, someone touching you. That's become really obviously important in the context of the pandemic, where people have experienced touch hunger because they're not getting touched by as many people. And actually a lot of salon worker client relationships are with, you know, it might be like elderly people, and that's like the only person that really touches them. So, you know, when we say treat yourself, what's being treated? You know, what's what is missing that's being treated here? What are the crises of the world that are being treated? What, you know, like there's something pretty profound going on that's much deeper than this very surface level thing that we think about when we think treat yourself as just consumption and pampering. And that's why the space of the salon is so fascinating, because there's so much of this stuff that's happening, right? And there's also, it's not just about emotions and technical kind of surface changes. There's this identity implication as well. So it's like your curation of self is happening through this. You know, how many people have you heard coming out of lockdown going to get a haircut and saying, I feel like myself again, I feel refreshed, I feel renewed. I felt like I lost my sense of self and now I have it back. And that's a very profound thing that's happening in that space that is not really attended to by just seeing it as this frivolous space of consumption and something extra in your life, right? Even though it kind of is that at the same time, there's a lot of other dynamics that are that unfold in those spaces.
The Australasian Post-Humanities Seminar Series is a digital, accessible space for thinking across disciplines, time zones, and travel bans. We exist to make the humanities radically accessible, so we run classes, reading groups, seminars, and more all across Australasia. You can join us at apost-humanities.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you there.